The U.S.-Israel genocidal war against Gaza continues for more than 4 months. The death toll is approaching 27,600. The leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement says Sana'a will intensify attacks on Israeli-linked ships if Israel does not stop the onslaught on Gaza. Lebanon's Hezbollah movement says it's targeted several Israeli military bases, causing some damage. I'm Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. Child killer is probably the first word that comes into your mind when one hears Israel. The regime keeps committing its genocidal acts in Gaza. It's killed several people, including two kids, in a new airstrike on the southern city of Rafah. Here's the father of a Palestinian who lost his kid in the attack.
This is the injustice of the Israeli occupation. He was a child playing. This is his brain. Look at how his brain came out. What did this child do to the coward criminal Israel? The child was 3.5 years. What did he do? They have taken a piece of my heart.
Now, elsewhere in southern Gaza, the regime targeted the vicinity of Nasser Hospital. It's located in the city of Khan Yunis, which has been the focal points of the recent strikes. In separate attacks on the same city, 11 people lost their lives. At least 10 people were also killed in an attack on a home in east of Jabalia refugee camp in northern Gaza. Israel's genocidal war in Gaza is now in its fifth month. Around 27,600 people, mostly women and children, have been killed in the Palestinian territory since October 7th. Palestinians have endured a catalog of miseries, including a lack of basic needs and displacement. Now, the Gazans recently released from Israeli prisons share harrowing accounts of torture and abuse that they were exposed to. The kidnapped Palestinians say they were subjected to severe beatings, dog attacks, repeated strip searches, and sexual harassment by regime forces. They were also denied food and water and were prevented from going to the toilet. Many of those released, which include women and children, have signs of torture on their bodies. According to Euromed Monitor, a recent report by Israel's own media shows that Tel Aviv practices systematic torture of Gazans. The rights organization says that Israel's ruthless assault on Palestinian detainees are tantamount to crimes against humanity. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says Israel is obstructing a ceasefire agreement in Gaza. Senior Hamas official Osama Hamdan says that Tel Aviv wants to continue with the onslaught and keep Gaza under siege. He reiterated the movement's demands for a ceasefire. Hamdan said it should be comprehensive and involve the full pullout of Israeli troops and removal of the blockade. Hamas is now reviewing a framework of a ceasefire deal offered to it after talks in Paris that involved Israeli, American, Egyptian, and Qatari representatives. Israel is under pressure from the international community and even its own Western allies to stop the military offensive in Gaza that's resulted in large-scale deaths and destruction. Now, in our explainer program, Mehdi Abbasian elaborates on the truce deal proposed to Palestinian fighters and provides details as to how it could work to stop the onslaught in the Gaza Strip.
It seems like there is another plan on the table of Hamas and Israel to look at the ways to stop the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war. This comes after preliminary discussions between Israel, the U.S., Egypt, Qatar. Hamas has confirmed receiving the proposal, so what exactly does this plan entail? Now, it is noteworthy to point out that this plan was first hashed out by the intelligence chiefs from Israel, the U.S., and Egypt, as well as the Prime Minister of Qatar, Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdulrahman bin Jassim Al Thani, in Paris. They called it the three-stage truce plan. So, what are the three phases that were hashed out that is supposed to lead to an end of this aggression that would satisfy the demands of both Hamas resistance group and the Israeli regime and its extreme cabinet? The first phase would consist of a pause in fighting and the release of elderly, civilian, and women and children captives. Major deliveries of food and medicine to Gaza would resume. The second phase would see the release of female Israeli regime forces and male recruit regime forces, another increase in aid deliveries, and the restoration of utility services to Gaza. Finally, the third phase would see the release of bodies of deceased Israeli regime forces in exchange for Palestinian prisoners freed. There are preconditions that need to be abided by during each of the phases. Military operations from both sides would have to stop during each phase, a complete stop, something unthinkable at this juncture in time. Another precondition depends on the negotiations when it comes to captive and prisoner releases. The specific number of Palestinian prisoners to be released at each stage will be determined with a focus on those who face long prison sentences. If all goes according to the plan, then the war will end and Hamas will ultimately release male Israeli soldiers in exchange for Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails. Hamas demands for a ceasefire approval don't quite add up to the reported three-stage truce plan. Hamas has previously demanded a permanent ceasefire as a precondition to enter negotiations. It wants guarantees and a plan for rebuilding the enclave. The withdrawal of Israeli regime forces from Gaza is also a demand, with ending the blockade the final demand. But other key resistance officials have also some key demands that doesn't appear the Israeli regime can meet. This is what Ziad al-Nakhale, the Secretary General of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad Movement, has said. A clear political solution that ensures the rights of Palestinians. Or how about Osama Hamdan, senior Hamas representative in Lebanon? He has said, in addition to the Hamas demands, that there needs to be an international recognition of Palestinians' right to self-determination, adding that there needs to be an establishment of an independent Palestinian state with Al-Quds as its capital. Something the Israeli PM and his cabinet have outright rejected. The far-right Israeli minister Itamar Ben-Gvir appeared to suggest that a deal with Hamas would trigger a cabinet collapse and an end to this unity cabinet. In this post on X, he said that a reckless deal would equal a cabinet split. This would mean the end of a unity cabinet. Meanwhile, the tally keeps increasing. Over 27,000 Palestinians murdered and over around 224 Israeli regime forces taken out, although this figure is grossly underreported by the regime. So, as with all truce agreements, this is no exception. It will be a difficult one to achieve, especially given that some of the demands from either side are enough to prevent a truce from happening.
The hundreds of angry Israelis critical of Prime Minister Netanyahu's handling of the genocidal war in Gaza have blocked entry of aid trucks into the Gaza Strip. Footage circulating online show outraged protesters surrounding trucks at Karam Abu Salem crossing, preventing the passage of more than 108 vehicles into Gaza. The regime previously declared the area as a closed military zone, saying that the aid is crucial to support the ongoing Israeli operations in Gaza. Israelis have staged numerous protests in the past months, slamming Netanyahu for ignoring the lives of scores of captives held by Hamas. A fighting on the ground intensifies in the Gaza Strip as Palestinian resistance movements continue to push back against invading Israeli forces. The military wing of the Islamic Jihad says it fired rockets at the gathering of IDF soldiers and military vehicles in Khan Yunis. The Al-Quds Brigade said it also targeted a group of Israeli forces inside a building in Gaza City, leaving many of them injured or dead. Fighting together with Hamas' Al-Qassam Brigades, they hit an Israeli helicopter with missiles west of the besieged strip. The military wing of Hamas says its forces targeted a group of IDF soldiers inside a building in Khan Yunis, leaving some casualties. Qassam fighters also fired mortar shells at an Israeli military command center in Gaza City. Tel Aviv has confirmed the death of more than 220 of its soldiers since the beginning of the ground invasion. Resistance groups say that the actual number is much higher. The regime is covering up its losses. Israeli forces have also killed another Palestinian in the occupied West Bank. They opened fire at an 18-year-old man near the city of Nablus, claiming he was approaching a military checkpoint to carry out a stabbing attack. Palestinian health officials say that the young man succumbed to the wounds after troopers prevented ambulances from attending to him. Meanwhile, Israeli forces stage a raid at an area near the West Bank city of Jenin. Several houses were stormed in the town of Al-Yamun. Regime troops attack Palestinians during the raid. They also intensified raids across the West Bank since October 7th. More than 370 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank over the past 4 months. Some 7,000 have also been abducted during the same period. Yemeni armed forces have conducted a new naval operation targeting two American and British vessels in the Red Sea. Abdul Latif al-Bashali, our correspondent in Sana'a, has a report.
In response to recent U.S. and U.K. airstrikes against Yemen, the country's armed forces have carried out a naval operation targeting American and British vessels.
The naval forces of the Yemeni army carried out two military operations in the Red Sea, the first targeting an American ship, Star Nasia, and the other targeting a British ship, Morning Tide. Both ships were targeted with appropriate naval missiles, and the hits were accurate and direct.
Sari added the Yemeni armed forces will carry out more qualitative military operations against all hostile American and British targets in the Red and Arab Seas. He said Sana'a reserves the right to respond to the U.S.-U.K. aggression against Yemen. Military experts said this operation proves that the Yemeni army is capable of handling more than one target simultaneously. They added that the targeted vessels were carrying military equipment to Israel.
This is the first military operation in which we target two ships at the same time, an American and a British one. And this is to confirm our ability to deal with more than one target simultaneously. And any attempt by the enemy to camouflage its ships at sea will fail. We can identify each ship. Both ships or one of them were carrying military equipment heading to the ports of occupied Palestine to support the Israeli enemy.
Recently, the U.S. and U.K. have intensified their strikes against Yemen, specifically targeting residential areas in Hodeidah City in a failed attempt to undermine the Yemeni army's capabilities and halt Yemen's naval operations. The Yemeni army has repeatedly affirmed that it will only cease its operations when Israel halts its genocidal war in Gaza.
Despite the continued attacks on Yemen by the U.S. and U.K., Yemen's army is expanding its naval operations in the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden, indicating that Western aggression has failed to affect the Yemeni army's capabilities. It has also vowed to confront Western escalation with broader operations targeting their interests in the region. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
In the meantime, the leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement says that the targeting of Israel-linked ships in the Red Sea will continue until the regime stops its aggression and lifts the blockade on the Gaza Strip. Abdul Malik al-Houthi said that acts by the U.S. and a number of Western countries that protect Israeli aggression will not affect Yemen's stance. He said that the latest move by the U.S. to camouflage Israel-bound ships will not limit military operations by Sana'a. Al-Houthi said that Yemen's operations will escalate if the Israeli genocide in Gaza continues. He added that the U.S., U.K., and Israel, that he called a triangle of evil, have failed to achieve any of their objectives. Now let's move on. Tensions keep flaring up along Lebanon's southern border as Hezbollah and the Israeli regime continue to exchange fire. The resistance movement says that the fighters hit several Israeli military bases in the occupied Shebaa farms. They also targeted Israel's Ramim barracks with two rockets, causing some damage. The Israeli military has also launched attacks on several areas in southern Lebanon. Hezbollah has been exchanging fire with Israel since the beginning of the regime's onslaught on Gaza. The resistance movement says that the attacks are in retaliation for the U.S.-Israeli genocide in the Palestinian land. Iran's ambassador to the United Nations says it strongly condemned U.S. attacks on Iraq and Syria, as well as Yemen.
Iran strongly condemns the U.S. military attacks on Syria and Iraq territory. The U.S. military action is illegal and unjustified and blatantly violates the basic norms and principles of international law and the United Nations Charter, particularly Paragraph 4 of Article 2 of the Charter. It is also a flagrant breach of Iraq and Syria territorial integrity, sovereignty, and political independence. Iran also strongly condemns the joint military action of the United States and the United Kingdom against Yemen, which constitute an obvious violation of the United Nations charters and international law.
Amir Saeed Irvani made a comment addressing a UN Security Council meeting on threats to international peace and security. is that such illegal measures target civilians and vital infrastructure and pose a great threat to peace and security in the region. He rejected U.S. claims that resistance forces in the region act on behalf of Iran.
All of the resistance groups in the region are independent, and their decisions and actions are motivated by their legitimate rights under international law that are ending the illegal presence of U.S. in their territories, stopping the genocide in Gaza, and ending the occupation of Palestinian territories. Therefore, any attempt to attribute these actions to Iran or its armed forces is misleading, baseless, and unacceptable.
The ambassador asserted that Iran has never sought to escalate tensions in the region and has no military bases in Iraq. The envoy noted that Iran's military advisors are present in Syria at an official request of that country's government. Iravani added that the only way to stop conflicts in the region is to abide by international law. He said that means forcing Israel to stop its genocide in Gaza and occupation of Palestinian lands, and also terminating the U.S. military presence in Iraq and Syria. Now, meanwhile, the Iraqi and Syrian envoys to the United Nations have denounced the recent U.S. airstrikes on their countries. The two diplomats in a Security Council meeting called on Washington to respect the sovereignty and territorial integrity of other countries.
The successive U.S. administrations have misused their permanent membership of the Security Council and interfered thoroughly in the internal affairs of other countries, including my country, Syria. They have formed military coalitions outside the umbrella of the United Nations and international relations legitimacy, perpetrating acts of aggression and occupation, exerting pressure and blackmail, collectively punishing and smothering peoples with unilateral coercive measures and inhuman, immoral blockades. Such violations impose the law of force over the force of law.
President, Iraq strongly condemns the American attacks which targeted military positions in Iraq on the night of the 3rd of February, which led to dozens of deaths and martyrs amongst personnel and civilians. This is a grave attack to official Iraqi security authorities, and this is a violation of Iraqi sovereignty as well as its security and the transgression of the laws that govern relations between states.
In Europe, farmers' anger shows no sign of cooling down. Spanish farmers have blocked their country's main highways with their tractors over a list of complaints. They gathered in the Catalan city of Girona as part of a countrywide protest. Similar events have been held across Europe recently, with farmers clogging the streets with their tractors in France, Germany, and elsewhere. They are discontent with low prices for produce and rising costs. Protesters are also critical of cheap agricultural imports from countries outside the EU. Farmers on the continent are also angry at restrictive environmental regulations on agriculture. The growing discontent has prompted the EU chief to announce the withdrawal of a controversial law that aimed to reduce the use of pesticides across the bloc. With that, we come to the end of this newscast from Tehran.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Islamic Revolution and Eradication of Deprivation. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Although Iranian people from all strata participated in the struggles leading to the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979, the deprived and poorer stratum played the main role in materialization of this victory. They were strongly opposed to the policies of the regime and the spread of the decadent Western culture, which was in pursuit of uprooting of religion and prevalence of promiscuity. The poor were also the most discriminated and oppressed parts of society. Therefore, among the main goals of the Islamic Revolution was to eradicate deprivation and injustice. In view of this, immediately after the glorious triumph of the revolution, development of deprived regions, especially villages, was out in the agenda. In the sixth episode of the special series on the 45th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, we will very briefly dwell upon some of the indexes of progress in the field of eradication of poverty and deprivation in the country. Stay tuned, please. The father of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, said, "I don't think there is a worship superior to servicing the deprived." In fact, Imam Khomeini's guidelines and emphasis urge people, particularly the youth, to rush to the help of poor regions. Thus, this popular body, which can be followed and copied as the best model of an NGO, was shaped up of young volunteers of mainly noted universities who were worried about the welfare of their fellow countrymen in their regions. Thus, they rushed to villages and outskirts of big cities to provide them water, power, road, hygiene, and other vital necessities. Many of these volunteers helped rural areas in harvesting their crops. During the regime of Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, nearly 75% of citizens and some 12% of rural regions enjoyed potable water. But now, the whole population in cities and more than 90% of villages have access to healthy and hygienic water. This has taken place so rapidly that, according to the recent report of the World Bank, the Islamic Republic ranks first in the region in the field of access to potable water in cities and villages. This while Iran is located in one of the driest regions in the world. Electricity is one of the main factors of welfare and development in any country. However, during the Shah's regime, despite his ample claims on the progress of Iran, the country, there were less than 3,000 power subscriptions, while the figure has increased 12 times after the Islamic Revolution. The production of power has also had a similar upsurge. Today, all houses in cities and villages enjoy electricity, and this has put Iran above the average global rank. Another gargantuan achievement of the Islamic Revolution is the spread of gas grid to almost entire country. As Iran is the second rich country in terms of oil and gas reserves in the world, in the waning years of the despotic regime of Mohammad Reza, the oil exports were 6 million barrels per day, whereas people were suffering from fuel scarcity. Thus, nearly half of the villages would heat their homes with wood. But now, gas lines have reached the remotest areas in the country so that 98% of inhabitants of cities and 83% of villagers enjoy natural gas. As for health and hygiene, rural regions and remote places lived in pitiable and very poor conditions during the Shah's regime. The Shah had done almost nothing in villages, and only 37% of cities enjoyed hospitals. The Islamic Revolution, however, totally changed the situation so that today, nearly 95% of cities have hospitals. There are approximately 1,000 active hospitals and 150,000 beds in hospitals in the country. These hospitals are equipped with advanced devices and apparatuses, most of which are made inside the country. Moreover, there are 18,000 health centers in rural districts, while this figure was only 134 before the revolution. In addition to health and treatment progresses, the healthcare insurance has had a dramatic increase, covering 95% of the population. While in the Shah's regime, very few enjoyed healthcare insurance and services, today 45 million Iranians, about 60% of the population, have been insured. Interestingly, 60% of this number lives in villages. According to the new health insurance, they do not pay for treatments. Furthermore, the life expectancy has increased from 53 to 80 among women, from 55 to 76 among men. Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, says the Islamic Republic is among the most successful ruling systems in the world in terms of replacement of service and wealth from the center, capital, to the whole country, and from the rich districts of cities to the lower parts.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
The audience of IRB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Ja'far Ja'far.
I begin in the name of Allah, the most kind, the most merciful. It's due to that kindness and mercy that we have these opportunities where we gather in remembrance and glorification of Him, Tabaraka wa Ta'ala. We then send our condolences to our 12th and living Imam Al-Hujjah, Ajalallahu Ta'ala, Farajahu Sharif, and to each and every one of you as we gather on this night to commemorate the Istishhad anniversary of our 7th Imam, Imam Musa Al-Kadhim, Alayhima, Afdalu Salatu Wassalam. Ma salli ala Muhammadin wa Ali Muhammad wa ajil Farajahum. We pray to Allah Subhanahu Wa Ta'ala that we each get an opportunity to go for the ziyarat of our Imam to Kadhimiyah, and that we receive his shafa'at in the hereafter, insha'Allah. Our 7th Imam alayhi salam was born on the 7th of Safar in the year 128 after Hijrah. And he lived approximately 55 years and was martyred on a night like this, on the 25th of Rajab in the year 183 after Hijrah. And so the lifespan, as we said, was about 55 years. And of those 55 years, 35 of them were as the Imam of the Ummah. That 35 years also coincided with the rise and the establishment of the power of the Abbasid dynasty. And what you also find within that was a sense of turmoil that was existing within the Abbasid, because it marked the end of the Khilafat of Mansur, and it brought about the rise of the Khilafat of Mahdi, Hadi, and then eventually Harun. So in a span of 35 years, the Imam alayhi salam saw four different people come to power. And the fact is that in that lifespan, or in that span, if you have so many people, you can imagine that there existed a lot of turmoil for there to be such a turnover in that leadership or that position of caliphate. But what existed as a common theme amongst all of them was their animosity or bughd towards the progeny of Ali ibn Abi Talib. And so what you find is that their behavior towards the Imam was one that was in line with how they have always behaved with the Imam. And it was full of brutality and hardship. And this is why we famously know that of those 35 years, nearly half of them were spent in prison because of how the Abbasids treated the Imam of our time. And it's in this that I want to take our lesson and develop our topic. And that is that, you know, when the Imam alayhi salam endured hardship, when the Imam alayhi salam endured these types of difficulty, we can in some degree bring that to our world when we endure hardship and when we endure difficulty. Because I believe firmly, you know, that it is in the times of hardship and in times of difficulty when we can really get a true measure of what type of faith we have. Yeah? It's not in times of ease. You know, times of ease, very easy to do shukr of Allah. Yeah, in times of ease, it is very easy to say Alhamdulillah. In times of minor difficulty, it's very easy to practice sabr. Yeah, but it is in difficulties, right? In hardships. Hardships like being imprisoned innocently. That would be a hardship, right? Hardship would be when we are faced with some type of event that was unplanned, that shook us, rocked us. And we're not talking about small things, we're talking about big things. That is when, you know, our commitment to the faith, the nature of our faith, is really brought into light for us to understand what type of faith we have. Because it's in these moments, you know, that the whisperings of shaitan are at its loudest, right? And that's when these ideas come about, you know. Sometimes you never even thought I had this idea. But when the voice comes out that, man, if he really loved you, would he do this to you? Yeah? That if he really cared for you, why would he not end your suffering right now, right? And these are the whisperings that sometimes we get in our heads. I think we all experience that from time to time, depending on the event that has taken place. It's really important that at those moments, we, number one, realize that this is the whispering of shaitan, right? And that it's not reflective of the weakness of my faith. Because sometimes that will just rock us in our faith and make us think we don't have faith, or rather just go towards a path where there is no faith. But we have to, number one, keep in mind that that's how shaitan works. Shaitan works by whispering these things. He knows, you know, shaitan is like throwing darts in the dark. You know, he's trying to see what will stick. Right, so he doesn't love you, or he doesn't care for you, and he wants to see that what thought will we allow our thought process to manifest and to percolate, you know, to continue. And so when it doesn't, when we just ignore it, he's all right, let me try something else. But these are the waswas of shaitan. And what we learn from our seventh imam, you know, is that when these types of difficulties arise, and when these types of whisperings take place, it's our absolute duty to turn to God even harder at these times, right? Because if I don't turn to God hard at this time, the only other recourse is shaitan. Remember, we've established, you're either in the party of God or you're in the party of shaitan. There's no in between, right? And so when I don't turn to God at moments like of difficulty, hardships, waswas, then I have nowhere else to go, and shaitan just sees me roaming around there. And this is why even when the Imam alayhi salam was put in this prison, what does he famously say? One of the most beautiful lines that we're all familiar with, right? Where he says, Allahumma innaka ta'lamu anni kuntu as'aluka an tafrighuni li ibadatik. He says, oh Allah, you know that I've always prayed to you to give me or spare me time so that I can worship you. Allahumma waqad fa'alta dhalik falakal hamd. Subhanallah, right? He says, you have given me this time in prison, and so I thank you that I can just concentrate. Like, even in that difficulty, the Imam teaches us that when you turn to God and you hold on to God, you will find the silver lining. you will find that area where you can rest in comfort. And so this point, I think, is really important for us to establish from the life of our Imam alayhi salam.
Ya bab al hawaij Musa ibn Ja'far. Ya bab al hawaij Musa ibn Ja'far.
Yes, the Imam was preaching. You know, people have preached for a long time, but the fact that people were gravitating towards him is what caused the most harm and anger within the Abbasid. And it is for this reason that our Imam alayhi salam was sent from prison to prison. And it is said that no matter which prison he went to, and when the orders would come to punish the Imam, the guards would say that what more can we do to this man? That we have done everything that we can, yet we find him with the best of akhlaq. Yet we find him in constant sujood to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Until the Imam alayhi salam was transferred to the prison of Sindi bin Shahak. It is this mal'oon who was known for his viciousness, where the Imam suffered the most brutality. And it is in this prison of Sindi where the Imam alayhi salam was fed with poisoned grapes, with poisoned dates. And it is said that when the Imam alayhi salam had swallowed these poisons, أخذ السم يسرى في بدنه والإمام يعاني أشد الألام. That the poison spread through the body of our Imam, and the pain and the effect on his body was immediate. The Imam began to feel pain, and the Imam would be turning from one side to another because of the pain that he was feeling. And it is said, he says, وَفِتِلْكَ الْحَالِ أَحَاطَ بِهِ الْأُزْحُزَنْ حَيْثُ لَا أَحَدُ مِنْ أَوْلَادِهِ عَنْدَ. He says that it was more difficult for the Imam, because the Imam alayhi salam was all alone in Baghdad, and there were no children of his around him, and hence there was this feeling of loneliness that the Imam felt. The poison spread through his entire body until that evening when sweat beads began to appear on the face of our Imam. The Imam stretched his hands and his legs towards Qibla.
Ya Imam al-Sabr wa ya Mawlana, ya Kadhim al-Ghayd wa Rajwana, fastashfa'na bika kulla zamani, wa tawassalna bika fi dunyana. Ya Bab al-Dham, ya Ali al-Jam,
this is Bahman.
the month which reminds us of love and empathy.
In the limelight.
If the child killer regime of Israel succeeded in persuading Biden to scrap UNRWA and transfer what they do to other agencies, the UN would no longer recognize up to 5 million Palestinians as refugees. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, "It is now crystal clear what Israeli regime officials had in mind when they briefed the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal about Hamas' alleged infiltration of the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA. We still find it hard to understand how readily Western governments across the Western world swallowed the bait without any fact-checking, and how, in the blink of an eye, 17 countries, accounting for just over $440 million, half of the UNRWA's operational budget, suspended funding. Recently, in which these countries should have been thinking about defunding the Zionist regime following the International Court of Justice verdict on provisional measures in South Africa's genocide case against the child killer regime of Israel, all the talk was about defunding the one UN agency that is keeping Palestinians alive in Gaza. In case anyone has forgotten, there is a war going on there. UNRWA is currently giving shelter to over 1 million displaced Palestinians in Gaza in 154 sites. It's not just the 13,000 Palestinians it employs. UNRWA is the largest relief agency operating in this war zone, a zone of unparalleled destruction. UNRWA trucks driven by UNRWA drivers pick up the meager supplies from the borders. They do the loading and unloading, sift through aid in their warehouses, and distribute it. They supply other UN agencies. Julia Tuma, UNRWA's director of communications, said, "If UNRWA disappeared, the consequences for Gaza are going to be catastrophic. And yet UNRWA ceasing operations is now a very real possibility." Tuma added, "If the funding does not resume, we will not be able to continue our humanitarian work, including in Gaza, beyond the end of February. We don't have reserves, no savings we can tap on a rainy day." So let us get the real reason why the Zionist regime is trying to collapse UNRWA. This has nothing to do with Hamas and little to do with the current war in Gaza. For this, we have to go back in time to the UN resolutions in 1947, the Zionist regime's creation as a state in 1948, and its admission as a state in the UN. The right of return of Palestinian refugees was first formulated by the UN mediator for Palestine Volk Bernadotte, who pushed for it during a truce arranged in June 1948. It would be an offense against the principles of elemental justice if these innocent victims of the conflict were denied the right of return to their homes, while Jewish immigrants flowing to Palestine, and indeed at least offered the threat of permanent replacement of the Arab refugees who have been rooted in the land for centuries, he wrote in his first general report to the Secretary General in 1948. Bernadotte, a Swede who saved thousands of Jews from going to the concentration camps, was assassinated by a Jewish underground group under the leadership of future Zionist regime Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir. But his right of return was incorporated into UN Resolution 194. This was made a condition of the Zionist regime's admission to the UN in 1949. The Zionist regime's representative at the UN, Abba Iban, was asked if Israel would honor its obligations under Resolution 194. Iban replied, "I can give unqualified affirmative answer to the second question as to whether we will cooperate with the organs of the UN with all the means at our disposal in the fulfillment of the resolution concerning refugees." UNRWA was established in 1949 to provide education, healthcare, and social services to the 700,000 refugees created by the fabricated regime of Israel. Today, UNRWA is the only UN organization that defines a Palestinian refugee as someone whose place of residence was Palestine between June 1946 and May 1948 and who lost their home as a result of the Zionist regime's conflict. The refugee status applies to all their descendants, which means it now aids more than 5 million registered Palestinian refugees in Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, the West Bank, East Al-Quds, and Gaza. If the Zionist regime succeeded in persuading U.S. President Joe Biden to scrap UNRWA and transfer what they do to other agencies like the UNHCR or World Food Program, the UN would no longer recognize up to 5 million Palestinians as refugees. No UNRWA, no refugees. No refugees, no problem. The Zionist regime accuses UNRWA of perpetuating the Palestinian refugee problem by allowing Palestinian refugees to transmit their refugee status to future generations. In fact, the Zionist regime is solely, serially, and repeatedly responsible for creating refugees and denying the right to return home. Recently, 12 ministers in the current cabinet were trying hard to create more refugees. They attended a conference calling to resettle the Gaza Strip, a chillingly public example of incitement to genocide being examined by the World Court. One of the founders of the movement to resettle Gaza is a convicted murderer, Ozi Sharbaf, who served 7 years for killing three students at the Islamic College in Al-Khalil in 1983. The conference was naturally attended by the bad guys, far-right National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir and Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich, but it was also attended by a strong showing from the Likud party. The conference debated the concept of voluntary emigration of Palestinian civilians in Gaza. No less a person than the communications minister from the Likud party, Shlomo Karchi, explained that in war, voluntary is at times a state you impose on someone until they give their consent. The U.S. lectures the world about a law-based world order. The World Court has ordered the Zionist regime to take all measures within its power to prevent acts of genocide and to punish acts of incitement. This is the response of 12 ministers in the cabinet to the World Court ruling, and Washington does nothing. Instead of forcing Israel's compliance with the World Court, a group of Jewish House Democrats discussed alternatives to UNRWA with Colonel Elad Goren, head of the Civil Department of Israel's Coordinator of Government Activities in the Territories Unit. Goren publicly denied that mass starvation is taking place in Gaza and claimed Israel has done its best to facilitate the flow of aid into Gaza. As if anyone had any doubt about Israel's intention. Netanyahu claimed recently that it was critical to end UNRWA's mission. America is being led down a path not only to regional war, it is being led down a path to destroy the lives of millions of refugees around the Arab world, an act that would, at a stroke, destabilize Jordan and Lebanon as well as all the occupied territories. It's insane for the U.S. to be complying with this. So far, Washington has shown absolutely no signs of realizing how dangerous for the world order this path is. When future generations write the history of the collapse of the United States as a world leader, it is moments like these that will go down as the seminal points in America's decay as a major global power.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The second phase of the revolution. On the occasion of the 40th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, February 11th, 2019. The Islamic Republic is not reactionary and it does not lack perception and understanding in face of new phenomena and situations. However, it strongly adheres to its principles and it is highly sensitive to its frontiers in relation to its rivals and enemies. It never imprecisely regards its principal lines and considers it important as why and how it would persist. Undoubtedly, the gap between the musts and the realities has always tormented the idealist consciences. However, this gap is fillable, and in the past 40 years it has been filled in many cases, and certainly in the future, with the presence of a young, faithful, wise and motivated generation. It will be filled more vigorously.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The Islamic revolution of the Iranian nation has been mighty, but merciful, forgiving, and even oppressed. It has not committed any of extremist and deviated acts that have marked many other uprisings and movements with stigma. In no conflicts, not even against the United States or Saddam Hussein, did it ever shoot the first bullet, and in all cases it defended itself after the enemy's attack. Of course, it blew the defensive strike vigorously. Since its inception, this revolution has never been merciless, nor has it ever shed blood. It has neither been passive nor hesitant, standing assertively and courageously against bullies and thugs. It has defended the oppressed. This revolutionary bravery and gallantry, this honesty, assertiveness, and sovereignty, this global and regional realm of action in support of the oppressed of the world, represent a source of pride for Iran and the Iranians, and may it persist eternally. Now, at the beginning of a new chapter in the life of the Islamic Republic, I would like to address my dear young people, the generation who steps up to start another part of the great jihad, selfless endeavor, for building a great Islamic Iran. The first section of my address concerns the past. Dear ones, you cannot learn but from your own experience or listening to the experience of others. Many of what we have seen and experimented, your generation has not experienced and seen yet. We have seen, and you will see.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.